Content note, this episode of So Many Books, So Little Time contains murder attempts, paranoia, murder attempts, very graphic descriptions of physical interactions with a bereaved and assassinating kind of creature, human, woman, and conspiracies regarding the well-being of a population that was being exploited potentially. Also mentions of World War II actual content and fairy bread.
Hey folks, Dave here.
Andrew.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Please join us today as we continue with Catch 22 by Joseph Heller with Chapter 38, Kid Sister. Now, the energy might be a little different this episode, dear listeners, because there's a couple differences. One, we're recording in person for the first time since, I think, March 2020. Mm-hmm. Rue is taking a short little vacation not too far from where I'm staying at the moment, so I drove up to meet her. We got the air conditioning on because it is a quite warm day out there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is our obligatory weather reference.
There may be more. And it seemed like a good idea at the time, but we had some dark chocolate milkshakes before we started, and the sugar is having an effect.
Yeah, I'm slightly out of it, and Dave is also very kind of, yeah. We're getting hit by the dark chocolate and the lactose-free milk. So, yes. It's been the biggest amount of dairy I've had in a while as well. Let's see how that goes.
So if you hear a bloating sound, yeah, it could be either of us.
Yeah, at this point, no. You probably won't hear anything. But I'm also in switch off mode, so my brain's not entirely awake because holidays.
Yeah. The perfect time to read one of the final chapters of this very dark book.
Yes. Excellent choices.
Well, actually, it may be better off because you kind of might not be in the headspace to have prepared yourself for what might occur in this chapter, so the reaction might be more authentic.
No, because I already know this is going to be a dark and painful thing to read, so it's all good.
It could be uplifting. I mean, it's called Kid Sister, so I assume it's about Nate Lee's loves. Sister, and now that Nate Lee is dead, well, I mean, what could be wrong about this chapter?
Yeah, this isn't going to go well. Oh, well, it's okay. It's what we do.
Now, last time, we did do two chapters. One of them was very short. Yes. The first one was the chaplain being detained in a basement and being convicted of ridiculous charges.
Yeah, that was some seriously weird Black Ops stuff. And then we had the chapter where Peckham outmaneuvered himself.
Where Scheisskopf is in control.
Well, sounds about right. And so, of course, the last thing that we ended on was he wants us all to march.
And obviously, I mean, we could be wrong, but I'm taking that as, you know, they completely misunderstand his intent.
Maybe, but I know he wants everyone to march parades.
Yes, but I think they think he wants everyone to march.
Because he knew that, because Peckham knew.
Yeah, but Peckham wasn't the guy. Scheisskopf wasn't talking to Peckham.
Oh yeah, he was talking to Cargill. Yeah, and because these are the Air Force, because these are the flight squadrons. So telling them to march, that's a bit of a weird thing to say.
You know, you could be right with that piece of information. Yeah, maybe they were just complaining about the parades. But I don't know, just the way it ended and the way it said it, and also, you know, the ridiculousness of everything. It's like...
Well, yes, everything is ridiculous about this. But yeah, so, I think the comment that I had is like, Yossarian, that's not going to go down well. Not that anything is going down well for Yossarian, really, but I think... The fact that the chaplain is going to be a bit more tense than usual.
And he may not be around much longer. Yeah. You know, they're going to punish him, but they haven't decided how they want to do that yet.
Well, him just walking around knowing that he's been convicted of something he hasn't done.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty punishment. And then they've made Dunbar disappear.
Yep.
So who knows what will happen.
Nately and Dobbs are now gone.
Yeah.
Who does he have left? Orr's
gone. Hungry Joe.
Hungry Joe's there, yeah. Anyone else? Because Hungry Joe's really not all there.
He has, but doesn't really. Milo's still around.
I wouldn't call Milo a friend.
No, no. Not that any... No, no. He's around. And unfortunately, Arfi is also around.
Oh, no. I was just thinking like people that were pleasant to Ysirion.
Oh, Arfi pleasant. Is not. None of them. None of them are really, though. No. The only one is I guess, Hungry Joe. This is as close as you're going to get.
Well, I think Milo considers Ysirion a friend, but I don't think he knows what friendship is.
Milo doesn't know anything unless it's got a dollar sign attached to it. Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, so...
So we continue, I think, today with this. We have a summary of last time. We have this. And yes, overall, we have a really nice view where we are right now.
Yeah, bringing the conversation up to a pleasant place before we go back into the mines, as it were.
Yes, and funny thing is that we're staring... Right now, we have a view of an island that's where we live. There's a little island that's called Wavebreak Island that, surprise, surprise, breaks the ocean waves. You're welcome. So Wavebreak Island, and I'm just thinking about Pianosa. And how it's on the bottom of the Italian peninsula, and I think there was also a little island, like kind of island like things, and it was little bits, so it just that kind of blew the ocean, the view.
Although Pianosa isn't being attacked by ladybugs.
No, yeah, there's an infestation of ladybugs outside on the balcony, and we haven't figured out. Why? Because we're not on the ground floor. This is quite high up. I think they're lost. I think something's, their navigational system has been disrupted.
My joke was they smelt the milkshakes, but.
Yes, well, fair. There was enough sugar in them. Oof. So this episode sponsored by insulin. Everyone needs it.
Some must have too much voluntarily.
Must have more.
Yeah, no, that's actually my, going off on a little tangent, that's one of my biggest problems is I've always had a sweet tooth, so I always feel I have too much sugar. And the times I've thought about, you know, I have tried to, there have been times where I've tried to cut it out altogether, that did not go well at all. And there have been times when I've tried to limit it to like the recommended daily amount.
So with sugar is such a weird one. It came up the other day on Twitter. There was a whole discussion on, well, technically, it's not sugar alone. Like, to say that you get diabetes because of sugar, so it's that you chose it, you had a lot of sugar, so that's why you've got diabetes. It's not actually an accurate approach.
It's more complex. Some people are afraid to eat fruit because of the sugar content, but to my understanding, it's like, well, no, there's so much else in fruit that counteracts the natural sugars that are in
there. There's nutritional benefit.
And the fiber.
Exactly. Yeah. There's fiber, there's nutritional benefit in terms of vitamins and mineral content and flavonoids and lots of really good things. The thing with sugar, so this whole idea of you have lots of sugar and diabetes is your punishment. That kind of approach doesn't actually gel with the reality of it.
Okay.
Some people genetically, yes, if they have an excess of sugar, that can trigger off their particular form of diabetes.
Let me just ask this, though. Yeah. Like, an excess of sugar, especially if it's in, like, you know, cookies and cakes and soft drinks and all that, it's not a good thing.
Well, no, it's not that it's a good or a bad thing. It's an excess of any caloric intake.
Well, yes.
An excess of any caloric intake will result in storage, and that can be a good or a bad thing. Like, if you're going into the deepest, coldest winter up in the Arctic, then having that extra caloric reserve is good. But yeah, it's a bit more complex, and I think the main thing that I just wanted to point out is it's okay to having a sweet tooth does not necessarily mean that you're definitely going to develop a problem in terms of a healthcare involved consequence.
That has always been in the back of my mind.
It is. And the thing is, but if you dwell on that and you stress about it, then you're going to also affect your cortisol levels, which in turn, that is more likely to cause problems with your metabolic pathways and your immune system.
Stress is really one of the worst things stress for us, isn't it?
Stress that is unrelenting stress is not good. Little pockets of stress that can help us kind of, you know, get out of a situation or move us or motivate us or inspire change. Little pockets, cool. Constant, unrelenting stress, no. And yeah, of course, there's going to be lots of advice, medical advice that is going to be contrary to what I was just sharing about the whole sugar thing. But I'm coming at it from a research perspective. It's to simplify it. For public health reasons, yes, of course, sugar should be a sometimes treat. Go easy on it. Go easy on the high calorie, dense kind of foods.
And fruit is great.
Fruit is great, but unless you're sensitive to it. But avoid the high calorie, dense and low nutritional value in terms of vitamins and minerals and other content. Be careful if you're going to go on a high protein diet. Consult a solid dietitian. And don't be stressed about when you're eating. If you're stressed whilst you're eating, that's going to be a lot worse in the long run. You know, think, plan, organize. Don't beat yourself up every time you have something that isn't necessarily quote unquote
unhealthy.
Well, where the caloric density is high. I'm being nice about it. It's like if it's a high calorie food, but there's low nutritional value.
Mm.
That's what we call them. Cookies are a sometimes treat. The updated version of Sesame Street. But yeah, it's a sometimes treat. You don't have to have it every day and constantly, but once in a while, it's not a big issue.
Well, that's one of the things I'm very thankful for is I never got into, I guess, the habit of like having like daily soda.
Yeah.
I've known so many people who that's just the way life works. And I'm addicted to water. I kind of get anxious if I don't have a water bottle nearby me, which I've probably gone too far the other way.
Sorry, it just reminds me. There was a skit made by an ophthalmologist where everyone might be familiar with it. If you're not, Dr. Glaucoma Flecken. I will not spell that. If you look up Glaucoma Flecken and comedy, he's funny. If you have a certain background in healthcare medicine, he's funnier. If you've had to deal with specialists, he's funnier. But he had a skit where he was playing the nephrologist and the med students coming into the nephrology ward.
What's that?
Nephrology is the kidney specialist.
Okay.
And the student is drinking water and the nephrologist is just staring at him going, what are you doing? He's saying, oh, I'm getting my, you know, 8 glasses of water in. And the nephrologist said, are you thirsty? It's like, no. Do you not trust your kidneys to work? What do you mean? Like, because we get a thirst signal if we need to drink, because our kidneys, the whole renin angiotensin system. But there are people where it is actually dysregulated. So that's why it's good to buy. A good bet is 8 glasses of water. But if you're overgoing over that, also not good for you.
Make sure you have salt. And that's another thing I've been told to caution about, because my snack of choice is a bag of potato chips, high in sodium.
Okay, given the amount of water you're having, it's probably not a bad thing. Because if you have too much water and not enough salt, your brain swells and you die. Don't do that. Everyone, make sure you're having your electrolytes when you're drinking water. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Make sure you have enough salt and you die.
I won't feel as bad for plowing away the whole bag in a single sitting then.
Don't beat yourself up over it. Happens once in a while. You're not doing it every day.
No, it's about a once a week thing.
You could take the same bag and split it into smaller packs. Have it every few days. Oh,
trust me, I would like to.
It's all good. But yes,
you agree with me right out there. Once you open the bag, it's as good as empty, right? It's going to go.
Sort of.
I'm just gonna try to eat one chip at a time. 5 minutes later,
it's gone. It's gone. Disclaimer, please, this does not constitute medical advice. Consult your physician or local healthcare workers who are familiar with your particular circumstances.
And now to catch 22.
This actually reminds me, we haven't heard about Dr. Danica or anything. Like, what's happened to him now?
No, it wasn't the other doctor they've sent to the Pacific.
Yeah, Stubbs is off to the Pacific. So Danica in the forest.
Yeah, Danica is, finger quotes, dead.
Yeah, as to whether what's happened to him. I mean, that because I was thinking that's another person that was left.
Last time he was hanging out in Chief White Halfoat's tent, but now Chief White Halfoat is dead too.
Yeah. Oof. So much death.
Well, so maybe, well, Flume moved back in, so maybe Flume's okay with Danica being there. I don't remember Flume being a negative, like a bad character. He was just scared of Chief White Halfoat, so he lived in the forest.
He was a very literal kind of, just, he was a bit irritating. I think that was what it was. He was a little irritating, but it was nothing wrong with him. It was just, and also easy to tease.
Well, wasn't it like Chief White Halfoat didn't like him because he was the only one that could sleep through Hungry Joe's snoring? Was that it?
Mm.
Like, I know Major had a problem with him too because, no, not snoring, Hungry Joe's screaming. That was what it was.
Yeah. And that freaked out Flume, and that caused...
The which I assume is night terrors.
Yeah, he's not well.
But the time for talk is over. The time for reading has begun.
Neat.
Chapter 38, Kid Sister. Ysarion marched backward with his gun on his hip and refused to fly any more missions. He marched backward because he was continuously spinning around as he walked to make certain no one was sneaking up on him from behind. Every sound to his rear was a warning, every person he passed a potential assassin. He kept his hand on his gun butt constantly and smiled at no one but Hungry Joe. He told Captain Pilchard and Captain Wren that he was through flying. Captain Pilchard and Captain Wren left his name off the flight schedule for the next mission and reported the matter to group headquarters. Colonel Korn laughed calmly. "What the devil do you mean he won't fly more missions?" he asked with a smile, as Colonel Cathcart crept away into a corner to brood about the sinister import of the name Ysarion.
Before we're running it down again.
As Colonel Cathcart crept away into a corner to brood about the sinister import of the name Ysarion popping up to plague him once again. Why won't he? His friend Natalie was killed in the crash over Spezia. Maybe that's why. Who does he think he is? Achilles? Colonel Korn was pleased with the simile and filed a mental reminder to repeat it the next time he found himself in General Peckham's presence. Oh, God. He has to fly more missions. He has no choice. Go back and tell him you'll report the matter to us if he doesn't change his mind. We already did tell him that, sir. It made no difference. What does Major say? We never see Major. He seems to have disappeared. I wish we could disappear him, Colonel Cathcart blurted out from the corner peevishly, the way they did that fellow Dunbar. Oh, there are plenty of other ways we can handle this one, Colonel Korn assured him confidently, and continued to Pilchard and Wren. Let's begin with the kindest. Send him to Rome for a rest for a few days. Maybe this fellow's death really did hurt him a bit. Natalie's death, in fact, almost killed Ysarion too, for when he broke the news to Natalie's in Rome, she uttered a piercing, heartbroken shriek and tried to stab him to death with a potato peeler. Bruto, she howled at him in hysterical fury as he bent her arm up around behind her back and twisted gradually until the potato peeler dropped from her grasp. Bruto! Bruto! She lashed at him swiftly with the long-nailed fingers of her free hand and raked open his cheek. She spat in his face viciously. What's the matter? He screamed in stinging pain and bewilderment, flinging her away from him all the way across the room to the wall. What do you want from me? She flew back at him with both fists flailing and bloodied his mouth with a solid punch before he was able to grab her wrists and hold her still. Her hair tossed wildly. Tears were streaming in single torrents from her flashing, hate-filled eyes as she struggled against him fiercely in an irrational frenzy of maddened might, snarling and cursing savagely and screaming, Bruto! Bruto! Each time he tried to explain. Her great strength caught him off guard, and he lost his footing. She was nearly as tall as Ysarion, and for a few fantastic, terror-filled moments, he was certain she would overpower him in her crazed determination, crush him to the ground, and rip him apart mercilessly, limb from limb, for some heinous crime he had never committed. He wanted to yell for help as they strove against each other frantically in a grunting, panting stalemate, arm against arm. At last she weakened, and he was able to force her back and plead with her to let him talk, swearing to her that Natalie's death had not been his fault. She spat in his face again, and he pushed her away hard in disgusted anger and frustration. She hurled herself down toward the potato peeler the instant he released her. He flung himself down after her, and they rolled over each other on the floor several times before he could tear the potato peeler away. She tried to trip him with her hand as he scrambled to his feet and scratched an excruciating chunk out of his ankle. He hopped across the room in pain and threw the potato peeler out the window. He heaved a huge sigh of relief once he saw he was safe.
Sorry, question. You're in the kitchen, right?
I think so, yeah.
Potato peeler is the least of the things you should be scared about, but yeah, sure.
Yeah. Now, please let me explain something to you, he cajoled in a mature, reasoning, earnest voice. She kicked him in the groin. Whoosh went the air out of him, and he sank down on his side with a shrill and ululating cry, doubled up over his knees in chaotic agony and retching for breath. Natalie's ran from the room. Yessarian staggered up to his feet not a moment too soon, for she came charging back in from the kitchen, carrying a long bread knife. A moan of incredulous dismay wafted from his lips as, still clutching his throbbing, tender, burning bowels in both hands, he dropped his full weight down against her shins and knocked her legs out from under her. She flipped completely over his head and landed on the floor on her elbows with a jarring thud. The knife skittered free, and he slapped it out of sight under the bed. She tried to lunge after it, and he seized her by the arm and yanked her up. She tried to kick him in the groin again, and he slung her away with a violent oath of his own. She slammed into the wall off balance and smashed a chair over into a vanity table covered with combs, hairbrushes, and cosmetic jars that all went crashing off. A framed picture fell to the floor at the other end of the room, the glass front shattering.
Pointing, though? There in her bedroom.
What do you want from me? He yelled at her in whining and exasperated confusion. I didn't kill him. She hurled a heavy glass ashtray at his head. He made a fist and wanted to punch her in the stomach when she came charging at him again, but he was afraid he might harm her. He wanted to clip her very neatly on the point of the jaw and run from the room, but there was no clear target, and he merely skipped aside neatly at the last second and helped her along past him with a strong shove. She banged hard against the other wall. Now she was blocking the door. She threw a large vase at him. Then she came at him with a full wine bottle and struck him squarely on the temple, knocking him down half-stunned on one knee. His ears were buzzing, his whole face was numb. More than anything else, he was embarrassed. He felt awkward because she was going to murder him. He simply did not understand what was going on. He had no idea what to do. But he did know he had to save himself. And he catapulted forward off the floor when he saw her raise the wine bottle to clap him again, and barreled into her midriff before she could strike him. He had momentum, and he propelled her before him backward in his driving rush until her knees buckled against the side of the bed, and she fell over onto the mattress with the Yessarian sprawled on top of her between her legs. She plunged her nails into the side of his neck and gouged as he worked his way up the supple, full hills and ledges of her rounded body until he covered her completely and pressed her into submission, his fingers pursuing her thrashing arm persistently until they arrived at the wine bottle finally and wrenched it free. She was still kicking and cursing and scratching ferociously. She tried to bite him cruelly. Her coarse, sensual lips stretched back over her teeth like an enraged, omnivorous beast's. Now that she lay captive beneath him, he wondered how he would ever escape her without leaving himself vulnerable. He could feel the tensed, straddling inside of her buffeting thighs and knees squeezing and churning around one of his legs. He was stirred by thoughts of sex that made him ashamed. He was conscious of the voluptuous flesh of her firm young woman's body straining and beating against him like a humid, fluid, delectable, unyielding tide, her belly and warm, live plastic breasts thrusting upward against him vigorously in sweet and menacing temptation. Her breath was scalding. All at once he realized, though the writhing turbulence beneath him had not diminished one whit, that she was no longer grappling with him, recognized with a quiver that she was not fighting him, but heaving her pelvis up against him remorselessly in the primal, powerful, rhapsodic, instinctual rhythm of erotic ardor and abandonment.
Ew. Did he? Did he really realize it?
Well, I mean, the switch from she's no longer trying to kill me was probably pretty obvious.
Maybe.
He gasped in delighted surprise. Her face, as beautiful as a blooming flower to him now, was distorted with a new kind of torture, the tissue serenely swollen, her half-closed eyes misty and unseen with the stultifying languor of desire. Caro, she murmured hoarsely as though from the depths of a tranquil and luxurious trance. Oh, caro mio. He stroked her hair. She drove her mouth against his face with savage passion. He licked her neck. She wrapped her arms around him and hugged. He felt himself falling, falling ecstatically in love with her as she kissed him again and again with lips that were steaming and wet and soft and hard, mumbling deep sounds to him adoringly in an incoherent oblivion of rapture. One caressing hand on his back slipping deftly down inside his trouser belt while the other groped secretly and treacherously about on the floor for the bread knife and found it. He saved himself just in time. She still wanted to kill him. He was shocked and astounded by her depraved subterfuge as he tore the knife from her grasp and hurled it away. He bounded out of the bed to his feet. His face was agog with befuddlement and disillusion. He did not know whether to dart through the door to freedom or collapse on the bed to fall in love with her and place himself abjectly at her mercy again. She spared him from doing either by bursting unpredictably into tears. He was stunned again. This time she wept with no other emotion than grief, profound, debilitating, humble grief, forgetting all about him. Her desolation was pathetic as she sat with her tempestuous, proud, lovely head bowed, her shoulders sagging, her spirit melting. This time there was no mistaking her anguish. Great racking sobs choked and shook her. She was no longer aware of him, no longer cared. He could have walked from the room safely then, but he chose to remain and console and help her.
So this is the grief, because she must have actually, if she didn't love necessarily Natalie, she would have seen him as the escape from the life that she was in, so yeah.
Mm. Please, he urged her inarticulately with his arm about her shoulders, recollecting with pained sadness how inarticulate and enfeebled he had felt in the plane coming back from Avignon when Snowden kept whimpering to him that he was cold. He was cold, and all Ysarian could offer him in return was, there, 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 there. Please, he repeated to her sympathetically, please, please. She rested against him and cried until she seemed too weak to cry any longer. It did not look at him once until he extended his handkerchief when she had finished. She wiped her cheeks with a tiny, polite smile and gave the handkerchief back, murmuring, grazie, grazie, with meek, maidenly propriety, and then, without any warning whatsoever of a change in mood, clawed suddenly at his eyes with both hands. She landed with each and let out a victorious shriek. Ha! Assassino! She hooted, and raced joyously across the room for the bread knife to finish him off. Half blinded, he rose and stumbled after her. A noise behind him made him turn. His senses reeled in horror at what he saw. Natalie's kid sister, of all people, was coming after him with another long bread knife. Oh no, he wailed with a shudder, and he knocked the knife out of her hand with a sharp downward blow on her wrist. He lost patience entirely with the whole grotesque and incomprehensible melee. There was no telling who might lunge at him next through the doorway with another long bread knife, and he lifted Natalie's kid sister off the floor, threw her at Natalie's and ran out of the room, out of the apartment and down the stairs. The two girls chased out into the hall after him. He heard their footsteps lag farther and farther behind as he fled and then ceased altogether. He heard sobbing directly overhead. Glancing backward up the stairwell, he spied Natalie's sitting in a heap on one of the steps, weeping with her face in both hands while her pagan, irrepressible kid sister hung dangerously over the banister shouting, Bruto! Bruto! Down at him happily and brandished her bread knife at him as though it were an exciting new toy she was eager to use. Ysarian escaped, but kept looking back over his shoulder anxiously as he retreated through the street. People stared at him strangely, making him more apprehensive. He walked in nervous haste, wondering what there was in his appearance that caught everyone's attention. When he touched his hand to a sore spot on his forehead, his fingers turned gooey with blood, and he understood. He dabbed his face and neck with a handkerchief. Wherever it pressed, he picked up new red smudges. He was bleeding everywhere. He hurried into the Red Cross building and down the two steep flights of white marble stairs to the men's washroom, where he cleansed and nursed his innumerable visible wounds with cold water and soap and straightened his shirt collar and combed his hair. He had never seen a face so badly bruised and scratched as the one still blinking back at him in the mirror with a dazed and startled uneasiness. What on earth had she wanted from him? When he left the men's room, Natalie's was waiting outside in an ambush. She was crouched against the wall near the bottom of the staircase and came pouncing down upon him like a hawk, with a glittering silver steak knife in her fist. He broke the brunt of her assault with his upraised elbow and punched her neatly on the jaw. Her eyes rolled. He caught her before she dropped and sat her down gently. Then he ran up the stairs and out of the building and spent the next 3 hours hunting through the city for Hungry Joe so that he could get away from Rome before she could find him again. He did not really feel safe until the plane had taken off. When they landed in Pianosa, Natalie's disguised in a mechanic's green overalls, was waiting with her steak knife exactly where the plane stopped, and all that saved him as she stabbed at his chest in her leather-soled high-heeled shoes was the gravel underfoot that made her feet roll out from under her. Yessarian, astounded, hauled her up into the plane and held her motionless on the floor in a double arm lock while Hungry Joe radioed the control tower for permission to return to Rome. At the airport in Rome, Yessarian dumped her out of the plane on the taxi strip, and Hungry Joe took right off for Pianosa again without even cutting his engines. Scarcely breathing, Yessarian scrutinized every figure warily as he and Hungry Joe walked back through the squadron toward their tents. Hungry Joe eyed him steadily with a funny expression. "Are you sure you didn't imagine the whole thing?" Hungry Joe inquired hesitantly after a while. "Imagine it? You were right there with me, weren't you? You just flew her back to Rome." "Maybe I imagined the whole thing, too. Why does she want to kill you for?" "She never did like me." "Maybe it's because I broke his nose, or maybe it's because I was the only one in sight she could hate when she got the news. Do you think she'll come back?" Yessarian went to the officers' club that night and stayed very late. He kept a leery eye out for Natalie's as he approached his tent. He stopped when he saw her hiding in the bushes around the side, gripping a huge carving knife and all dressed up to look like a Pianosan farmer. Yessarian tiptoed around the back noiselessly and seized her from behind. "Caramba!" she exclaimed in a rage and resisted like a wildcat as he dragged her inside the tent and hurled her down on the floor. "Hey, what's going on?" queried one of his roommates drowsily. "Hold her till I get back," Yessarian ordered, yanking him out of bed on top of her and running out. "Hold her! Let me kill him, and I'll ficky-fick you all," she offered. The other roommates leaped out of their cots when they saw it was a girl and tried to make her ficky-fick them all first as Yessarian ran to get Hungry Joe, who was sleeping like a baby. Yessarian lifted Hupple's cat off Hungry Joe's face and shook him awake. Hungry Joe dressed rapidly. This time, they flew the plane north and turned in over Italy far behind the enemy lines. When they were over level land, they strapped a parachute on Natalie's and shoved her out the escape hatch. Yessarian was positive that he was at last rid of her and was relieved. As he approached his tent back in Pianosa, a figure reared up in the darkness right beside the path, and he fainted. He came to sitting on the ground and waited for the knife to strike him, almost welcoming the mortal blow for the peace it would bring. A friendly hand helped him up instead. It belonged to a pilot in Dunbar's squadron. "How are you doing?" asked the pilot, whispering. "Pretty good," Yessarian answered. "I saw you fall down just now. I thought something happened to you." "I think I fainted." "There is a rumor in my squadron that you told them you weren't going to fly any more combat missions." "That's the truth." "Then they came around from group and told us that the rumor wasn't true, that you were just kidding around." "That was a lie." "Do you think they'll let you get away with it?" "I don't know." "What will they do to you?" "I don't know." "Do you think they'll court-martial you for desertion in the face of the enemy?" "I don't know." "I hope you get away with it," said the pilot in Dunbar's squadron, stealing out of sight into the shadows. "Let me know how you're doing." Yessarian stared after him a few seconds and continued toward his tent. "Psst," said a voice a few paces onward. It was Appleby, hiding in back of a tree. "How are you doing?" "Pretty good," said Yessarian. I heard them say they were going to threaten to court-martial you for deserting in the face of the enemy, but that they wouldn't try to go through with it because they're not even sure they've got a case against you on that, and because it might make them look bad with the new commanders. Besides, you're still a pretty big hero for going around twice over the bridge at Ferrara. I guess you're just about the biggest hero we've got now in the group. I just thought you'd like to know that they'll only be bluffing. Thanks, Appleby. That's the...
Sorry, it's interesting that Appleby is now reaching out because it's been a while now.
Mm.
And I think he's probably...
Oh, yeah. His enthusiasm when he arrived would be long gone.
Yeah.
That's the only reason I started talking to you, to warn you. I appreciate it. Appleby scuffed the toes of his shoes into the ground sheepishly. I'm sorry we had that fist fight in the officers' club, Bessarion. That's all right. But I didn't start it. I guess that was Orr's fault for hitting me in the face with his ping-pong paddle. What do you want to do that for? You were beating him. Wasn't I supposed to beat him? Isn't that the point? Now that he's dead, I guess it doesn't matter anymore whether I'm a better ping-pong player or not, does it? I guess not. And I'm sorry about making such a fuss about those Atabrine tablets on the way over. If you want to catch malaria, I guess it's your business, isn't it? That's all right, Appleby. But I was only trying to do my duty. I was obeying orders. I was always taught that I had to obey orders. That's all right. You know, I said to Colonel Korn and Colonel Cathcart that I didn't think they ought to make you fly any more missions if you didn't want to, and they said they were very disappointed in me. Ysarion smiled with rueful amusement. I'll bet they are. Well, I don't care. Hell, you've flown 71. That ought to be enough. Do you think they'll let you get away with it? No. Say, if they do let you get away with it, they'll have to let the rest of us get away with it, won't they? That's why they can't let me get away with it. What do you think they'll do? I don't know. Do you think they will try to court-martial you? I don't know. Are you afraid? Yes. Are you going to fly more missions? No. I hope you do get away with it, Appleby whispered with conviction. I really do. Thanks, Appleby. I don't feel too happy about flying so many missions either, now that it looks as though we've got the war won. I'll let you know if I hear anything else. Thanks, Appleby. Hey! Called a muted, peremptory voice from the leafless shrubs growing beside his tent in a waist-high clump after Appleby had gone. Havermeyer was hiding there in a squat. He was eating peanut brittle, and his pimples and large oily pores looked like dark scales. How you doing? He asked when Ysarion had walked to him. Pretty good. Are you going to fly more missions? No. Suppose they tried to make you? I won't let them. Are you yellow? Yes. Well, they can't marshal you. They'll probably try. What did Major Major say? Major Major's gone. Did they disappear him? I don't know. What will you do if they decide to disappear you? I'll try to stop them. Didn't they offer you any deals or anything if you did fly? Pilchard and Wren said they'd arrange things so I'd only go on milk runs. Havermeyer perked up. Say, that sounds like a pretty good deal. I wouldn't mind a deal like that myself. I bet you snapped it up. I turned it down. That was dumb. Havermeyer's stolid, dull face furrowed with consternation. Say, a deal like that wasn't so fair to the rest of us, was it? If you only flew on milk runs, then some of us would have to fly your share of the dangerous missions, wouldn't we? That's right. Say, I don't like that, Havermeyer exclaimed, rising resentfully with his hands clenched on his hips. I don't like that a bit. That's a real royal screwing they're getting ready to give me just because you're too goddamn yellow to fly any more missions, isn't it? Take it up with them, said Ysarion, and moved his hand to his gun vigilantly. No, I'm not blaming you, said Havermeyer, even though I don't like you. You know, I'm not too happy about flying so many missions anymore either. Isn't there some way I can get out of it too?
Wow, so because remember the last time Havermeyer got spooked?
Yeah.
So, they've broken even the most staunch of their pilots.
Yeah, he was just there to kill the enemy.
Yeah, and
he's done.
He's done, yeah.
Ysarion snickered ironically and joked, put a gun on and start marching with me. Havermeyer shook his head thoughtfully. Nah, I couldn't do that. I might bring some disgrace on my wife and kid if I acted like a coward. Nobody likes a coward. Besides, I want to stay in the reserves when the war is over. You get $500 a year if you stay in the reserves. Then fly more missions. Yeah, I guess I have to. Say, do you think there's any chance they might take you off combat duty and send you home? No. But if they do and let you take one person with you, will you pick me? Don't pick anyone like Appleby. Pick me. Why in the world should they do something like that? I don't know, but if they do, just remember that I asked you first, will you? And let me know how you're doing. I'll wait for you here in these bushes every night. Maybe if they don't do anything bad to you, I won't fly any more missions either, okay? All the next evening, people kept popping up at him out of the darkness to ask him how he was doing, appealing to him for confidential information with weary, troubled faces on the basis of some morbid and clandestine kinship he had not guessed existed.
Yeah, they're all struggling. They've all had it.
He's turning into a leader.
Yeah, we're just going to tick off all of the brass that have been...
Well, Cathcart thinks he's some sort of, like, you know, cursed spook anyway. People in the squadron he barely knew popped into sight out of nowhere as he passed and asked him how he was doing. Even men from other squadrons came one by one to conceal themselves in the darkness and pop out. Everywhere he stepped after sundown, someone was lying in wait to pop out and ask him how he was doing. People popped out at him from trees and bushes, from ditches and tall weeds, from around the corners of tents and from behind the fenders of parked cars. Even one of his roommates popped out to ask him how he was doing and pleaded with him not to tell any of his other roommates he had popped out. Yessarian drew near each beckoning, overly cautious silhouette with his hand on his gun, never knowing which hissing shadow would finally turn dishonestly into Nately's or worse, into some duly constituted governmental authority sent to club him ruthlessly into insensibility. It began to look as if they would have to do something like that. They did not want to court-martial him for desertion in the face of the enemy, because 135 miles away from the enemy could hardly be called the face of the enemy, and because Yessarian was the one who had finally knocked down the bridge at Ferrara by going around twice over the target and killing Croft. He was always almost forgetting Kraft when he counted the dead men he knew, but they had to do something to him, and everyone waited grimly to see what horrible thing it would be. During the day, they avoided him, even Arfi, and Yessarian understood that they were different people together in daylight than they were alone in the dark.
Notice Arfi, because Arfi likes to torment him. He's avoiding any association with him at all. Climber, yeah.
He did not care about them at all as he walked about backward with his hand on his gun and awaited the latest blandishments, threats, and inducements from Group each time Captains Pilchard and Wren drove back from another urgent conference with Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn. Hungry Joe was hardly around, and the only other person who ever spoke to him was Captain Black, who called him Old Blood and Guts in a merry, taunting voice each time he hailed him, and who came back from Rome toward the end of the week to tell him Nately's was gone. Yessarian turned sorry with a stab of yearning and remorse. He missed her. Gone, he echoed in a hollow tone. Yeah, gone, Captain Black laughed, his bleary eyes narrow with fatigue, and his peaked, sharp face sprouting as usual with a sparse reddish-blonde stubble. He rubbed the bags under his eyes with both fists. I thought I might as well give the stupid broad another boff just for old time's sake, as long as I was in Rome anyway. You know, just to keep that kid Nately's body spinning in his grave. Ha ha. Remember the way I used to needle him? But the place was empty. Was there any word from her? Prodded Yessarian, who had been brooding incessantly about the girl, wondering how much she was suffering, and feeling almost lonely and deserted without her ferocious and unappeasable attacks.
Something is seriously wrong with Yessarian.
Well, we know that.
Yeah, more so.
Oh, I miss the way she used to try to kill me.
Wow.
There's no one there, Captain Black exclaimed cheerfully, trying to make Yessarian understand. Don't you understand? They're all gone. The whole place is busted. Gone? Yeah, gone. Flushed right out into the street. Captain Black chuckled heartily again, and his pointed Adam's apple jumped up and down with glee inside his scraggly neck. The joint's empty. The MPs busted the whole apartment up and drove the right out. Ain't that a laugh? Yessarian was scared and began to tremble. Why'd they do that? What difference does it make? Responded Captain Black with an exuberant gesture. They flushed them right out into the street. How do you like that? The whole batch. What about the kid's sister? Flushed away, laughed Captain Black. Flushed away with the rest of the broads, right out into the street. But she's only a kid, Yessarian objected passionately. She doesn't know anybody else in the whole city. What's going to happen to her? What the hell do I care? Responded Captain Black with an indifferent shrug. And then gawked suddenly at Yessarian with surprise and with a crafty gleam of prying elation. Say, what's the matter? If I knew this was going to make you so unhappy, I would have come right over and told you just to make you eat your liver. Hey, where are you going? Come on back. Come on back here and eat your liver.
He's such a weirdo. Man.
Well, that was quite a chapter.
That was something.
What I do like is there, you know, we're in the last part of the book, and I've talked before about how bleak it's getting, but there was some levity in that chapter.
Some weirdness, that's what that is.
I think what I found the funniest is how almost like a Looney Tunes cartoon.
They're popping out of everywhere, and you're going...
Well, Nate Lee's...
Yes, the murder attempt.
Yeah, she's a mechanic, she's in the bushes. She's just...
I mean, I wonder if she, how much is Cesarion seeing this?
Oh, yeah.
And how much of it is he seeing all the attempts as blurring together?
Well, because, yeah, the only time he ever got injured was that first time.
Yeah.
So the rest could be in his head, that's true.
Except his tent mates also recognized that she was there, and Hungry Joe flew out with her to dump past enemy lines. So there's many, many things that explain that it could be real, but also I wonder if it's multiple people.
And Hungry Joe did ask, are you sure that actually happened? He's like, you were there. And it's like, yeah, well, I don't know.
But Hungry Joe's not a reliable witness. So,
yeah, and he seems to understand that about himself.
Which is a whole nother level of messed up. But if he is seeing this happen and it is happening, it doesn't necessarily have to be her. It could also be just other people that are upset and blame Ysarion.
But...
Because I'm trying to remember, why would they blame Ysarion? Why... because Milo... Because Ysarion told Milo, and Milo went to Cathcart about the number of missions.
I mean, yeah. The only thing I see against that is we don't know if they know that that's what happened. Like, if anyone else...
Except it's Milo. Milo's going to be saying things like that.
But also, it just seemed like there was a clear division between, like, the attempts on his life from her and then everyone. Even Arfi was coming to him...
No. Everyone was avoiding him during the day. And at
night. But at night. Sorry, it wasn't Arfi at night. No. It was Havermeyer.
Yeah, Havermeyer. That was the most shocking one. Yeah.
But yeah.
Appleby and Havermeyer were odd.
But then it said, like, everyone was coming to him at night, even people in different squadrons. And it sounds like he was having this, well...
Well, this is also post-Dunbar disappearance.
Yep. And they, but, you know, he had the same conversation three times in a row. It was Dunbar's squad mate, it was Appleby, and then it was Havermeyer. Yep. And from the sound of it, he probably had that conversation dozens of times over
and
the next few nights.
And he just doesn't care anymore. He's hit the point of he doesn't know, he is afraid, but he can't.
And he's like, yeah, they're probably going to do something to me, because that was the other thing. You know, they can't let him get away with this because it's their honor online.
But they can't punish him the way they want to punish him because he's a hero.
Especially because, yeah, if they punish him as well, it's like, well, why is he doing this? Why is he flying 71 missions, and why are you punishing? Yeah, it's all going to come crumbling down.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a mess.
So as he put it, he's like, they probably have to disappear me. That's the only way they get out of it.
The whole thing is a bit chaotic. And then also the other question is has the Natalie's been asked or incentivized to...
Oh!
Because that would be the easiest way to get rid of him.
And Khorne and Cathcart did send him to Rome.
Yeah, they did. And Khorne and Cathcart know about everything and the fact that the MPs cleared out the place and all that. So they basically said, we'll kick you out if you don't successfully kill Ysarion.
And they could, you know, the chapter is called Kid's Sister. They could have threatened the sister to get
There's so many ways.
And I mean, it kind of makes a kind of perverse sense as well, because at the end, you know, that was what Ysarion was concerned about.
Yep.
It's like, she's just a kid. What's going to happen to her?
Yeah.
And then Black, of course, is like, oh, well, if I knew you were going to be this upset, I would have come to you right away. Because he's Black. Such a piece of crap.
Anyway, so lovely characters, you know, full-bodied flavor of the human. These are the broken, twisted, gnarly remains of humanity.
Which makes her
actions make more sense.
Yes, because even like obviously she, I think the grief was real.
Yes.
But just the two times she was able to sucker him in, it was quite remarkable, really. You know, he let her cry her eyes out, basically, and then right at the end, boom, right again. And
yes, so the fact that she's motivated to kill him has to come from something else. And the fact that there's other attempts as well, like in other... How did she get to Pianosa?
Yeah, because it felt like a Droopy cartoon or a Bugs Bunny. Like,
so either he's seeing things or it's being instigated and coordinated by the powers that be.
And the funny thing is either seems plausible.
I reckon that's where the book ends, is kind of driving you to go. It's like questioning, is this real? Is this not real? Could this happen? Could this not happen? How far will they go?
Mm.
And I mean, Shazkopf is not going to be happy about the fact that he keeps disrupting the marching.
you know, we say it so matter of factly, but then, you know, you take a step back and you look at it and you're like, this man, he's in charge now of a whole company, and all he cares about
is the march.
and while, like, I think it was Appleby who said it's ridiculous because the war is almost done, so this must be late days, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, just so odd.
It's crazy town. But he is.
Offhand, I don't know how versed you are in World War II history. Do you know when when the Russians broke into Berlin? Because that was the end of the German war effort, wasn't it?
I think 1946, but I might be wrong.
Because, I know her, like, the war ended officially in 1945 when the bombs were dropped on Japan, but I think Germany fell a lot earlier. Rue's looking it up, which is good. I'd like to get this right.
Okay, so don't search Russians Berlin, because that's not going to help you. Invade Berlin.
Because I think that's the day that Hitler committed suicide, was when
I
they took
I can't remember the dates. Berlin. It's been too long. 45, 20th of April, 1945.
Okay, in June, I believe, was when the bombs were dropped.
So on Hitler, this is a little piece of information I didn't actually know. On Hitler's 56th birthday, the Soviet artillery of the 1st Belarusian Front began shelling Berlin and did not stop until the city surrendered.
That's almost serendipitous.
Well, look, I think it's intentional.
You very much could have been.
So between April and May 1945.
Okay.
And...
So yeah, like if...
Oh, they did some nasty stuff, but let's not go down that path.
Yes.
Google just... Google, it's Fairy Bread Day. I accidentally tapped what's that thing called when you tap the Google and it's looking different, the Google sign. I know there's a word for it. And it just gave me a shower of fairy bread.
Well, it just made me laugh because I looked over at Rue's phone. Again, this is something that could only happen because we're in the same physical space recording this. But, you know, oh, the Russians did some horrible things. Let's not look at that. No, fairy bread. Well,
the Russian, I was scrolling up and my finger slipped and it hit the weird Google thing. You know, those things. I don't remember. Like, you know, it's Day of the Dead or whatever. They have a special Google symbol.
Yeah.
Or... 100 years of x-rays or whatever, and I accidentally brushed against it, and that's what I got. Fairy bread.
It made the fairy bread ring down.
So weird. okay. End of World War II. But yeah, this is the...
Right. So I'm just going to spitball and guess that maybe this book takes...
September 1945 was formal surrender documents were signed.
I'm going to guess that this book probably takes place in like early 1945.
Probably.
Like, oh, can you just quickly look up when the Americans, like, took over Italy?
No, that was before.
I know it was, like, a while before.
So, end of World War II, so I can go World War II, Americans, Italy. Go. Italian campaign. Not helpful. Italian front, 1944.
Okay.
I think. World War II, Americans, Italy, free Italy. The liberation, 1945, 1943 to 1945, I think.
Okay. So finally liberated in 1945.
Yeah, 1943 was specifically Sicily.
So this really could be in the final year of the war.
It's anywhere between 1943 to 1945.
Mm.
In that thing. Again, we are sure there's someone who's actually done this properly and matched events with.
Well, this plays into that thing I talked about very early on when we were still in the opening chapters of the book, when I was talking to my Polish friend about this book. And I said one of the things that I picked up on the first time I read it when I was much younger is how, from the point of view, it just seemed like the book had this theme, like war was just so frivolous and unneeded and maddening. And his response was, well, for the Americans having to be over in Europe, that's probably right. For us, like in Poland, it was our lives.
But the difference is also the fact that there isn't an invasion to begin with comes from a warlike mentality of conquest.
Yes.
So even for those populations that were invaded, war is senseless and material conquest like that is an invasion kind of mentality is not helpful. The freeing, the interfering with a tyrannical or a invading force, defense, is different to engaging in warfare.
And despite which side you plop down on in terms of those ideas, it almost doesn't matter in this book because the main theme is just... Let me finish this thought.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the main theme is how the prolongated war effort, how it's mentally affecting our characters.
Yeah. That being said, I think there's a point, he made a point a few times where he's going, the motivation and the principles of, he's making a commentary on the principles. We had Captain Black who's like, why are we fighting against an enemy that espouses American ideals.
Yes, yes.
Right? So the fact that it plays into the fact, without going into too much of the stuff, a lot of the things that were happening in Germany were actually directly inspired by the segregation laws in the United States.
Yeah.
And the attitudes and the approaches there. Not that it's something that is exclusively that bigotry and... that kind of treatment is exclusively an American export. It's something that technically is a very European source kind of originated thing. But
kind of, I again, like war, I don't believe it's hard-coded into us as humans, but you look at any, like, especially through history, it's almost like every country almost has their own form of that propping up in some...
Yeah, but it's also because, look, our maturity hopefully will increase as we go on. It's going to take time, but I think a few generations and hopefully unnecessary, and the expression here is unnecessary military intervention will become something that is archaic and dismissed and no longer relevant. And where necessary military intervention is going to be a very clearly defined situation.
A scalpel instead of lopping off a limb.
Pretty much. Like, we're going to move away from literally chopping off the legs to let's actually just stitch that artery. So we're going to become more and more refined, I think, in how we do it. And what that could look like, what a necessary intervention would be, for example, as your friend in Poland was saying, for us, it was kind of a necessity. So, well, yes, it was your lives. So that would be, for example, a necessary military intervention in order to prevent the loss of life and the safety and the security of people.
Yeah.
Versus, we don't like this ideology. We like this ideology. We don't like the way these people think. We want them to think this way.
Yeah.
We want to control the resources. We want to... There's many reasons we did it.
Yeah.
Or we want to continue our industry of producing innovation that is and an economy that is completely based and fueled by military intervention and engagement. So, yes. You know, war machine for a reason.
That seems like science fiction. Not at all what's happening in the U.S. at the moment.
Or any country. It's not at all. No economies could possibly be based on war.
Going back to the book,
yep.
I guess this whole conversation relates to the book, but do you now, like I keep saying we're in an end game and it's just the habit of, you know, we're moving slowly because it's a chapter and episode, but actually, I think this was kind of a turning point seeing how now the troops are starting to rally around Yserin. Do you have any thoughts about where the book's going from here?
They're going to have to be very, very clever how they approach Yserin. But it's going to be doable because there are people who are very smart and know how to outmaneuver him. If they don't get outmaneuvered themselves by their own machinations.
I don't know if they are that smart.
No,
because
Horn isn't. Well, Peckham is dangerous.
But look how they handled the chaplain, that whole situation. That was a ridiculous...
That wasn't Peckham. Again, that wasn't Peckham. Peckham wasn't in charge yet then.
No, but that guy without the insignia, he's obviously one of like the shadow ops, right? And he was not... That was not a smart approach to...
No, but I'm thinking in terms of... with Viserion, you don't have to be too smart. You just have to...
True, they got rid of Dunbar.
Just threatening, like even that kid's sister, they might, saying that she's on the street, maybe she's not.
Maybe they got rid of the whole building.
Maybe they kept the kid's sister as a hostage.
Or maybe because she failed her mission.
Yep. So there's a lot that can still be done, and yeah.
And you know, while we're really attacking the competence of all the brass in this book, we have to think about the American war effort in World War II. They did... very successfully succeed in a number of very high
complex
missions of, you know, Normandy being probably one of the pinnacles of.
Yeah, but it's not just them. So it's
But I mean, you know, I guess with the themes of this book, especially, it's easy to forget that, like with every profession and every machine or every group. While sadly, this one especially is geared towards personal ambition.
Yes,
there are still those who are in positions of power that are highly competent, and they're there for the right reasons.
And but this one's all about extremes. Like this is all about creating an extreme kind of. I mean, like we said with the other books, it's all about taking the concept and pushing it to its extreme. Mm. That's how we do things.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Well, the next chapter for next time is called The Eternal City. Thoughts?
That's the Vatican, isn't it?
Is it? I guess they are in Italy.
I don't know. It's a thought.
Actually, that's something I might want to look into. I wonder what happened with the Vatican during World War II.
Complicated.
I imagine so. But until next time, folks, we thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this chapter in our discussion. Let us know how different the energy was. You know, it was actually really cool to record in the same space again. We'll probably be going back to online for a while.
Just for a wee bit, and then we'll figure it out.
Because I am moving into a new place closer to where Rue lives, and we might be able to...
make it work.
Yeah, make it work, which I think would be beneficial for everyone involved. Yeah. But until next time, the music at the top of the podcast is Soap Runs. It's by Rupert Gregson-Williams and Harry Gregson-Williams. The music at the end of the podcast is I'm the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
You can find me at RumiKmoo on Twitter. And you can find our podcast at SMBSLTpodcast. That's on Twitter and on Facebook. And if you add @gmail.com, you get our email address so you can drop us a line. And of course, please leave reviews if you are listening to this podcast on any sort of reviewing option. And we look forward to your engagement in any which way. Hopefully in the next few chapters when we wrap up, we will tell you exactly what the next book will be.
Well, we usually do that on the final chapter of the episode.
Exactly. So you will know fairly soon.
And so will I. I have an idea, but...
I'm always like in flux. I'm always not sure until the second last episode.
Maybe you should actually leave the final decision until that recording. And no. Then I can be like, oh, really?
Okay. Second last episode, I'll know which one it is. And then I'll surprise Dave.
No. As co-host, it's probably good for me to actually know what direction we're
in. Especially because we have to pick the music and all that.
Mm. Yes. But yes, until next time, I hope you're staying safe. Please enjoy your reading. And we'll see you next time.
Okay.